It's Opinions Are Cheap with Cameron and Chad. Yay! It's been a couple weeks. I've been very busy.
Yeah, it's been a pretty crazy couple weeks. It's been crazier for you than me. I've just been like sad and depressed, and the weather's been bad.
I mean, I haven't been so far off of that, but yeah, I guess I had other things to do on top of that.
Yeah, you had more things to do than that, whereas I was just like, well, it could stop raining, and I could stop being upset for no reason. But I'm off sober month, and I feel like alcohol helps a lot, which is scary, but, you know, you lubricate the gears any way you can so you can function in society.
Have you, like, do you drink kombucha?
No, what is that?
It's good. It's like fermented tea.
Oh, huh.
I recommend maybe having a kombucha once a month just to help like flesh out the system a bit.
Is it like a cleanse, like, but with fermented tea?
Yeah, there's like a detox mixture you can get that's pretty good at making you feel refreshed.
Hmm. I could see trying something like that. Well, I feel like part of me is like, or I could just not drink the last week of every month and you know.
No,
show rare restraint.
Well, the thing is, I kind of treat the kombucha like its own treat.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of like, I mean, it's not like alcohol where it like fucks you over or something, but it's also kind of like, oh, I'm getting the nice one in the bottle that like maybe it costs a little more than I should be spending on one drink, but it's like, I'm only getting one this month. I'm going to get this nice one. It looks nice.
Sure. I was explaining to you off the air, but my coworker on May 1st brought me 3 samples of bourbon, and I was really happy. And she's like, I couldn't remember what you wanted other than one of them. So I asked my husband to just pick for me, and I hope you like these. One of the ones she gave me, because we talk about some of the more budget whiskeys you can try. And she's like, this is one of my favorite, like, $22 bottles. And it's called Old Tub. It's at 100 proof. It's a Jim Beam product. And for $22, this is a really, really good bottle. So this is my endorsement for that, people. If you want to try to get into, like, bourbon, you don't know where to start, and you don't want to spend a lot of money, Old Tub, if you can find it, is a good place to go. And if you don't like it, you're only out $22 and you can mix it guilt-free with your soda of choice. But it's got a nice kind of caramel taste. It's got a little bit of oakiness to it. It's got like a peanut aftertaste, and then it's over. It doesn't linger at all. It's good.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about you guys visiting out here on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And we got all these like microbreweries and stuff, so you could try some local things that you can't get otherwise. But also, it's like, I don't know if they even care. Like, why? Why bother?
Because you can't get it anywhere, and it would be an experience.
It would be, but I feel like we can go somewhere, and you can try their IPA, and whether or not you like it, you kind of had the experience of the other 20, like, local IPAs.
Oh, sure.
On that street, you know?
Yeah, that's got to be hard. Like, how do you stand out when there's... when it's become the flavor of the month, you know, the IPAs or the stouts? Like, we have a couple microbrews in La Crosse, and I like them both. I feel like there are just few enough where they all can do something a little different and occupy a different market share. But I also don't drink a lot of their product, and so for all I know, they compete, and I just don't know it.
Yeah, and you know, I feel like one of the bigger ones out here is Belching Beaver, which is not necessarily hard to find elsewhere.
Oh, sure.
Have you ever had one?
No, but I feel like the name's familiar. I don't know if I've seen it or if you've mentioned it.
Yeah, I think they're big enough to distribute out, like, across the country. So, I mean, I think if we want to go somewhere nice, we could go to Belching Beaver because they have a very good, like, appetizers and lunches and stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
But their hook is their peanut butter beer. And it's like, I hate gimmicky stuff. I'm not huge on IPAs anyways, but they kind of figured it out, and it's good. And it's like, I don't want it to be good because it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
But it's good. And then, like, there's smaller ones. And I think I have a couple smaller ones in mind that I would love to share. But at the same time, like, if you're not feeling an IPA, I can't blame you.
I've grown to like IPAs, so I will definitely try whatever you would recommend.
Drinking's fun. I miss drinking.
Yeah, I'm sorry you can't currently. We were at a bar last Friday, and the shot of the day was a mixture of rum shotta and blackberry brandy. And that tasted really fucking good. I don't normally like some of that stuff, but I was like, God damn, imagine mixing this with, like, if you put a little vodka in there, you could, like, turn it into a martini. I think you could mix it with ice cream and it would taste like awesome. It'll make like a mudslide of sorts out of it. It was just a really good mixture. I was like, I cannot believe how much I'm enjoying this. But I wanted to talk specifically today about a thing, unless we want to keep vamping, which I'm totally fine with doing. I don't want to railroad us into a topic, but I did have a topic.
Go on.
I've been reading some old fantasy books. I've talked about this before because I've been reading them for a couple months because it's a big series. And I think one of the fun things about them is like the world building aspect to the books. And it made me think, like, what constitutes good world building? What constitutes bad world building? When does it even matter? The crux of the Deathgate cycle, which came out in like the 90s, so spoilers, but it's been like 40 or 30 years. It's not my fault no more. Two really strong magic people were fighting, and one was like, we're the good guys, and they're the bad guys. And the other one was like, we're maybe not the bad guys, but we're not the good guys either. And they're trying to take over the world. And so the good guys are like, we're going to blow up the world and turn it into multiple worlds. And then we'll run all of those. And then the humans and the elves and the dwarves will make them get along and it'll be better. So they split the world into four worlds, one air, water, earth, fire, you know, your basics. And they're all pretty different. And then they built like a prison planet for their enemies. And then there was, there's like another secret world that is like, I think the afterlife that involves like strong magic and also God is real. But that's for the seventh book. But the worlds themselves are really fun. And they're kind of, in a way, what you would expect. Like the air world is a bunch of like floating islands that rotate. And there's a storm at the center. And the water from the storm is what, you know, how all of the islands get water. And there's a freaking giant machine in the storm that like harvests water, and that's where the dwarves live. Because they like to be underground, and being in the machine is kind of like being underground. And they can take care of the machine and give everybody water. And it all went to shit because, I mean, if you think about that for more than 10 seconds, you're like, that's a stupid idea. Why would you do that? And then like the fire world is basically Jupiter but hollow, and there's suns in the middle, and there's lots of vegetation on the outside. And it's always day all the time, which is kind of annoying. And then there's the rock world is also a hollow earth thing. But the problem with lava and inside hollow earth stuff, if it's rocks, is there's nowhere for toxic chemicals to go. Because apparently this was also a toxic world. So like they built that, and then all of the non-godlike creatures just died right away because it was too poisonous. So they fucked that one up. The water worlds, it's just water, and then there's a sun in the middle, but it moves, and so sometimes there's ice, and sometimes there's not ice, and it's weird and doesn't quite make any sense, but they're all really fun, and it doesn't make sense on purpose. It's because the godlike people who were like, we're going to build four great worlds, and they're all going to interact, and we're going to be the rulers, and everyone will love us, did not put enough thought into how these worlds should work. They just were like, rule of cool, we're gods now. And that's kind of, you know, a theme of the story. Maybe don't do that. But the worlds are fun. I really like the worlds. And I've been talking a lot now, but I'm kind of curious, like, you know, you're hearing this for the first time, Cameron. Like, what do you think of, like, good world building? Like, if you're going to make a world, and you're like, oh, air world, floating islands, I love that. I fucking did a whole book about that. Like, I literally, I put that in a novel that I wrote that's, like, 90,000 words. You know, I forgot what I'm... It's not that I forgot what I'm talking about. It's just I forgot that there was maybe a point to this rambling.
Okay.
I'm glad we're doing this again. I missed you.
I mean, I could help you here, but it's funnier to watch you just think.
I need you to help me. I've lost the plot.
Well, I guess that's my question is, when you say world building, Do you mean like literal world building, or do you mean like story background world building?
And that's the thing, is I don't know, because I feel like they're two sides to the same coin, but they're very different sides to that coin. Like if you flip the coin and you got one and the other, you could heads or tails that shit. I look at like Lord of the Rings, and I feel like the world building in Lord of the Rings is good because it's huge. It's huge in terms of time. There's a lot of depth. There's a lot of history. There are complex like families with like genealogy. But at the end of the day, how much of that is like cool or good storytelling or engaging versus, hey, we're in a hollow earth with like four suns and it's daytime all the time. Also, there are giants wandering around killing people with clubs. And you're like, well, that's fucking fun. But it doesn't, like it doesn't really make any sense. And you're like, what happens if you go down to the trees? Well, then you get to the dirt, and that's where the dwarves live, and there's dragons down there, but they're green dragons because it's a jungle world. And there's a certain, like, childishness to these books in a way, like, when you really reduce them down. But in the moment, they're really fun, and they're really engaging. Versus, I don't know, even, like, the Game of Thrones book, Song of Ice and Fire, like, once again, ton of like research and thought and lore into these worlds, but a lot of it's on like the periphery. Or you look at something like Halo. Halo's got a shitload of world building going on, but a lot of it's not in the games. Like, you gotta go to like the wikis and the books to find it. So is it good? I don't know.
So I want to go back to Game of Thrones. So with Game of Thrones, my understanding is that the setting has like history. Like, Merton has a canonical history and the region all like planned out. And even if stuff hasn't necessarily come up yet, he knows. And he's working with these moving pieces as like the foundation, right?
Yeah.
And I think that not everything has to be Game of Thrones, but I find that stuff really interesting. And then the polar opposite is maybe like when you're playing a Legend of Zelda game. And it doesn't actually geographically make sense, but there's like a mountain pass where you walk through the mountain pass and now you're in the desert, and the desert has its own set of laws.
Yeah.
Because it's a new level in a video game. And yeah, it's like a kid adventure thing where it's like, and then they found the desert, and the desert had the desert people, and there was a giant sandworm from Dune. And it's like, whoa, how did you fight the Dune worm? You got the mask, and now you're giant, and so you can wrestle the worm. That's cool. And it's just kind of like they're having fun with it. It's not necessarily like an actual ecology built in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like, I'm trying to like grapple with the two very distinct ways that people build worlds and rules. And I like them both, but I think my gut says the ones that are more like, hey, let's have fun and not worry about how things fit together or logic, I like that more, just because it's like you get like this dopamine hit right away. It's like eating candy. And like I really appreciate the work that goes into some of the bigger lore pieces like Halo. Like, there's clearly a lot of thought into the Covenant and the Forerunner, and then whatever came before the Forerunner, because I think there was stuff before them, and how the Halo rings work and the Flood. Like, all that stuff's really cool. But at the end of the day, like, I'm there to shoot aliens on really neat set pieces. And it does that really well.
You know, I wonder if you would be interested. I could send you some, like, there's a YouTube channel that does these, like, Pathfinder lore essays. And a lot of them are set up as, like, regions. So it's like, here's the desert level, and here's a bunch of interesting factoids about the desert level. And what this guy is doing is he's basically piecemealing maybe what a handful of official adventure packs said, and what a book said, and what the DM guidebook said, and like putting it all in one spot so you can reference it.
Okay.
And they're kind of interesting. Like, you might actually enjoy the video for what they are. But it's also very interesting how, like, specifically with Pathfinder, there is like a canonical story and a canonical world. Like, you can look up the world map, and it's weird because I'm used to, even though D&D kind of has a world map, almost every game I've been involved with is very much like, none of that really matters. Like, you can use words like Baldur's Gate or the Underdark or whatever you want, but it's kind of like it relies a lot on freeform.
Yeah.
And a lot of like new adventures tend to just make stuff up for that adventure. And with Pathfinder, it's weird how like I'm in this campaign right now where I can go to a website and there's a world map and I can actually like research nearby cities and figure out what trade routes might be, and we could like plan a trip and we could ask the GM, hey, can we go up north here? Like, how long would it take to travel? Because we want to buy a level 6 wand and the city has level 6 items in it. And he could like arrange that for us. And I'm not used to that degree of planning and like world sim, I guess.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is interesting. I think they're different styles. I'm not even prepared to say I like one or the other, but this is interesting how there's like a canonical style.
Yeah.
I think we talked about this the other day, but I said that like a new like world building book just came out, and it's been a little like controversial with the fan community.
Hmm. Yeah, you did mention that.
I'm trying to. So it's the Tianzia World Guide. And oops, sorry, button. And I guess like this is the weeb book where this is like the country, or no, not the country, but it's like the continent that is all very heavily like Asia Eastern, sort of probably Polynesian too, like inspired lands, but not necessarily one to one. Like there's not a Japan and a China, but there are straw hats and rice farmers.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And with this book in particular, it's not actually like a rule book. Like it doesn't give you playable like classes and like the ancestries and stuff. It's kind of just context for the different regions and the different countries in this land. And I guess where some of the frustrations coming from, like I on the Reddit, like it was getting so tense that like one of the moderators started like abusing his power, and they had to issue an official apology and like remove him from the moderation team because people were getting like heated about it.
Wow.
And it's like, well, why? And I guess it's just because, like, in Pathfinder 1, there was, like, samurai and ninja as classes. And this continent already existed. Like, there's kind of context already based on Pathfinder 1. And with Pathfinder 2, they said, we're not going to do a samurai or ninja class. And we're rewriting some of the lore for the region. And it's not so much a rewrite or a retcon. It's just that, like, after time has passed, here's the current state. And it feels like they've watered everything down.
Huh.
That's the vibe I'm getting. I can't actually judge because I didn't read and compare all these details. Like, this book just came out.
Sure, sure.
But I guess, like, there used to be a couple countries that were the quote-unquote evil ones. And for different reasons. Like, one of them, I think, was, like, undead-themed. And that's where all the yokai and ghosts live. And then there's another one where it's like a super dictatorship and there is no war in Ba Sing Se. And I guess both those things kind of get watered down and everything's just kind of nice and pleasant.
Oh, that sucks.
And people reading this book are saying how like, yeah, I want to run a game, but it's like this book doesn't say like what any threats would be for adventurers to like, you know, like if you go there,
sure.
Do you get attacked by bears? Like, I don't know. Like, what am I supposed to do with any of this information? And it's interesting because it's pretty, like, it's a decent-sized book, and there's a lot of stuff and pictures and, like, I want to say flavor. Like, it's pure flavor text. And I'm not even opposed to that because I think these world guides are normally kind of like that. It's just that it feels like they maybe intentionally avoided anything that was negative because they don't want to, like, be called racist or something by, like, someone, like, reading it and saying, like, oh, I get it, you hate Chinese people.
And yeah.
Like, well, no.
You got to be careful when you're playing with stuff like that. But like you still can do it. It's just you have to like get, you know, hire people with a background in that or from those regions, you know, sensitivity readers. Oh, no basically. One cares. But
they do that and it still happens.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't want to talk about like actual like world politics. I want to talk about game design.
Yeah, game politics. Design. Well, and here's the thing.
And like story, you know, like again, like I love every good story has decent conflict.
Yes.
And I don't know why, like, what's wrong with having, like, an evil skeleton wizard that's evil? And it's like, hey, you know what? If you have a party of adventurers, maybe they'd want to stop this evil wizard and just throw him a bone, you know?
And for something like Pathfinder or D&D, that definitely makes some level of sense. If you're reading, like, a book, I don't like the evil for the sake of it anymore because I'm not, like, 12. And, you know, a criticism I would have of Lord of the Rings is Sauron and Mordor and the orcs are all kind of evil for the sake of it. And when I did the episode with Alice and Emily, we talked about Lord of the Rings. Tolkien actually kind of felt bad about that. You know, he questioned, like, if that was smart. He's like, the way I've written orcs, like, do they have souls? Like, you know, they should be a little more two-dimensional, right? Like, did I fuck this up? Because really, they're depicted almost like an environmental hazard, like a storm. They just kind of sweep through.
Did you ever see that, like, sequel to Lord of the Rings?
The Amazon one? Or the Silmarillion? No. Or Silmarillion?
No, like the book, the unpublished book that he never finished.
No.
It's very interesting because there's, like, I guess a chapter that he was working on. And it's like Aragorn has two sons or something. Or maybe their grandsons. I don't remember how far it goes. But there's basically just this, like, philosophical thing where the one brother is, like his view is, like, well, if you're going to use orc as an insult to call someone evil, then, like, you're basically saying that they're just evil and there's no good in them. And then the other brother had a philosophical view that, like, are there not, like, gradients? Is there not, like, a good orc compared to a bad orc? And from that point, is there no human that's worse than is there a bad human that's worse than a good orc? And is there overlap there? And it sort of felt like, oh, you know, he's actually kind of working with something interesting here.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a bummer that he maybe didn't finish that book.
I feel like the D&D world went through that at one point. I mean, having read a lot of the Forgotten Realms books with Drizzt in them, that orcs start off as very painfully black and white evil, and then there's a shakeup within the rules, and all of a sudden, oh, the orcs are, you know, they have goals, and they're actually a lot more humanistic than we give them credit for, and then you get to the end of at least the last book that I had, and there's like a half-orc, and she's teamed up with a gnome that has appeared throughout the series, and they're going to go on an adventure and have some fun, and maybe there's going to be their own little D&D party that's coming together, and that'll be a spinoff book. And ultimately, I like my worlds like that, where things are not so set in stone. Yeah, the character's name was Nanfoodle, and he was a gnome that liked to build stuff.
You know what? I don't care. If they're going to... Yeah. They can write whatever the fuck they want. I don't care.
Okay, this is like 10 years ago. I have no idea if this, like, side story ever came out. It's not important. But the thing is that, you know, it was showcasing the real change in the lore where, hey, a half-orc can be friends with a gnome and they can go on an adventure. Versus early in the books where all the orcs were bad. Drizzt needs a good body count this novel because that's why we're here. Let's just have him kill a shitload of orcs.
You know, this is a sidestep, but have you ever looked into, like, that history of D&D? Like the very first kind of edition when it wasn't its own book?
No, actually.
So it was actually like an add-on to a different game called Chainmail. And Chainmail was a lot more like Warhammer or Risk, where it was like a war game.
Okay.
And Dungeons and Dragons was kind of like hero mode, where you have, like, you establish one castle instead of macromanaging a kingdom.
Oh!
And you have, like, heroes. And there's, like, specialty rules for, like, if you want to have a wizard in your army, here's how the wizard works. And if you want to have a warrior, and it was zooming in a bit. And it was, like, baby steps towards something that you can almost recognize as D&D, but it really wasn't.
Okay.
That's interesting. There's a bunch of YouTube videos about that. If you love seeing pasty white guys with beards, they will all explain it to you.
Yay! I think one of the things...
What was my point?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. No, so I want to... So back to this, like, world guide book.
Okay.
Where some people are reading it and they feel like, well, yeah, but what am I supposed to do with this? And I feel like sometimes worlds are a backdrop, and it's very important to have a good backdrop for your play. And sometimes worlds are a character.
Yes.
And I think that what's important is the character part to my favorite stories.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about how I treat that, because I feel like a lot of my stories, the world is more of a backdrop. And
you know what fiction I like a lot, but the backdrop and the world is like really, really lame? Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the backdrop is cool to look at. I don't know if there's a simplicity to certain things in Star Wars that when you start to drill down, you may be left a little disappointed. You know, you want a little more out of it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, it is a good backdrop for the stories it's generally telling. And, you know, you work with what you got, and you... My thing when I world build for my stories is, like, I do as much as I need. So I'm not going to sit down for 3 hours and plot all this lore and all these intricacies. I'm going to kind of try and plan my roadmap a bit and then make up what I need and then make up what I need on the spot if I forgot something or didn't go that far. And then I'll fix it in editing. And there are times when I feel like that's probably not the way to do it. And that's why my world building feels more of a backdrop than a character. But I don't know, like, I look at Stormbreather, which was my pirate book where all the islands floated around a giant tornado. And very, very similar to the one of the worlds in the Deathgate books that I'm reading, which I didn't notice until I started to read. I was like, Jesus, I cribbed a bit here. I was subconscious. I didn't mean to just steal wholeheartedly. But the world is still an obstacle. Like, it's very much a thing they have to deal with and overcome. And so does that make it a character, or is it just a really prominent backdrop? Like, what's the distinction there?
You know, that's a very good question. And I'm actually kind of wondering, because it's like, I think something that's interesting, there's a really old cartoon, not really old, but 90s, The Pirates of Darkwater. Do you remember that?
Oh, God. I want to say yes, because I definitely know the name.
Google it, and you'll immediately recognize the art style, or you won't.
I recognize the art style. When did I watch this? I'm pretty sure I've seen this. I don't recognize it, but I really recognize it, you know?
You were probably like 6 or 7.
Okay, that will...
when it was on TV.
That's fair.
Pirates of Darkwater was a very interesting show because I feel like the production budget was higher than it should have been. Like, I think that's one of the reasons why it failed was they treated it like a little bit better than G.I. Joe, and maybe they shouldn't have.
Okay.
Like, for economical reasons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the end result is a beautiful cartoon about pirates. And what was neat was, like, a picture like a fantasy pirate adventure, where there's like kind of like an elf sort of a character, and there's like a talking parrot man that's like half monkey, and it's sort of like, you know, this could just be a D&D party. And the gimmick was, like, imagine a world like One Piece where there's a lot of water and like sea culture and pirate culture is just like inescapable. But then there's like a chunk of water where like it operates different than the ocean. And it's like, you can't swim in it. Like, there's no buoyancy.
Oh, interesting.
And it's like, it was like a tar or something. I don't remember. But it was like this threat where it's like, only like outlaws have to go out into the dark waters and risk their lives because like normal sailors wouldn't. And it's just like, like the international waters of the international waters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of these things where there wasn't a whole lot to the ocean, but that threat, like the idea that like, oh yeah, don't fall overboard because you can't come back.
Yeah.
It almost felt like borderline space travel, where it's like, oh, this is like a ship or a submarine, but also don't open the door, you'll die.
Yeah.
Where there's just like one extra layer of danger at all times. And I feel like that really stuck with me because I couldn't tell you a single character name. I couldn't tell you a single plot. I'm fairly certain there was a character that kind of looked like a Klingon, and I always thought, oh, it's a Klingon, like from my dad's show. Like, that's how vaguely I remember the show. But it was so interesting, and just that idea of, like, oh, the Dark Water, that's cool.
Yeah.
That stuck with me so much, more so than the named characters.
Yeah, I think the mechanics of the world are, like, its own thing. Because there's, like, what the world looks like, and, you know, history, and how things interact. And then there's the people in it. But then there's, I don't know if mechanics is part of character, if it's part of world building. But, like, if you have, like, the way a warlock has to deal with a, you know, a demon to get its powers, like, is an interesting mechanic. Or, the rune magic in the Deathgate books were, like, one of the characters, it's very, like, verbal and spoken, and they kind of sing and dance and draw them in the air, versus the other one, they have to, like, etch it onto stuff. And, you know, they it's the same kind of magic, but it operates very differently, so they have to kind of deal with that. You know, like, oh, I use it this way, versus he uses it this way, so if we fight each other, it's going to be kind of a mess. That stuff's fun.
Okay. You know, this is abstract, but I want to run this by you. I want to say Star Trek is very much a backdrop setting. Like, you could take these stories and just put them anywhere. It doesn't have to be even in space.
Yeah. That's fair.
But I'm thinking about Battlestar Galactica. The whole narrative is they're the last of the humans. And they're looking for some place that they could live without killer robots trying to kill them. And so, even though it's sort of just space adventures, and it's a random adventure of the week or whatever, the fact that they are there, it's like, yeah, but there's like a clicking, there's a ticking clock element.
Okay.
And there's like a motivation that's universal. Like, every living human feels exactly the same way that, like, yeah, you're being hunted right now and you need to find somewhere to go. And I feel like that helps the setting give it personality, even though it's literally just a spaceship in dark space.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. I feel like the world should be tangible. I think, like, Lord of the Rings and Dune especially, like, The way the characters have to deal with that planet and the sand and the lack of water. I mean, it's in, like, every fucking paragraph of that book. Like, you know you are on Arrakis when you read Dune. And I think Lord of the Rings is the same with Middle Earth, and it's a lot less combative. But there's just a prominence to the vegetation, or the lack of it, depending where you are. The animals and how they're treated. I mean, there's a thick aspect to Middle Earth. That you know you're in Middle Earth when you're reading Lord of the Rings, and I really appreciate that. Technically,
I think Dune, not just Arrakis, but even the other planets are, like, they're so alien and like powerfully presented. Like, that's a very good example of a fiction with a well done world building thing, even if the planets are one note, which is my problem with Star Wars.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me in Dune because it feels like with the scale that you're working at, that's warranted.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I feel like Star Wars, Tatooine especially, could be so much more of a character. I mean, there's so many fucking Star Wars stories that take place on it. But you'd have to find a way to make it not Dune, because it's already very Dune. And I don't know. There's so much more to do with Tatooine than is done, and I feel like that's really a missed opportunity, especially given, like, Jabba the Hutt and some of the crime stuff going on there. The frickin', I guess the Sarlacc pit is kind of just a dune worm that doesn't move, but still, it's a little different. You got the moisture farms; those are cool. Like, I don't know, pod racing's neat. Like, there's just something missing though. Like, it's not Arrakis. Like Dune is a play setting that you see the cardboard in the background, but it's painted okay. And then you go to Dune is this interactive, like, 3D space, and you can put your hand in stuff, and, you know, they're just very, very different levels of depth.
You know, I've said this before, but I went to see The Wizard of Oz once in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting because there's a couple scenes where you see them, like, skipping off towards the Emerald City or whatever. And you can see, like, there's always exactly one frame where they're skipping and then they stop. And you realize that you can kind of see their shadow and they're actually, like, just nose to backdrop.
Oh.
And they, like, they could have cut one frame sooner, but they didn't. And there's, like, a 90 degree angle at their feet that you couldn't see before.
Sure.
And you never saw on your television.
I think with the Deathgate books, which kind of inspired this, is the worlds are very similar to the Star Wars ones, where they're very fun settings until you start thinking about them and how the play of the characters and the politics and everything would work over a long period of time. And the answer is it wouldn't. And to be fair to the books, they hit the point where, like, there is a breaking point and things aren't working anymore. And that's part of the conflict, that the worlds don't quite mesh or make sense. Ultimately, it serves the plot of, like, hey, maybe people who think they're gods and are going to destroy the planet and make their own planets, that's a bad idea, because it was. But it doesn't change the fact that I'm supposed to believe that for thousands of years, characters have inhabited this planet, and this is the state of it, and this is the history of it, and, like, it doesn't really work. I still like them, though. I will say one of the things I wanted to bring up to today is Pokemon, because I think Pokemon is
a great
example of, like, the world building and Pokemon is stupid. Fucking nothing makes sense if you think about it for more than 5 minutes. But I don't care because I there's stuff about Pokemon I just really, really like. And I will overlook it and it doesn't matter because it is a backdrop for a game mechanic and a vibe. And it does those things. Yeah, like, Pokemon doesn't make any sense if you ask, like, one question.
I like the one, like, they're at, like, a big, like, buffet or something, and there's a lobster, and it's like, wait, is that a Pokemon, or do they just have animals? Like,
yeah.
Like, are Pokemon the animals of the universe, or are Pokemon, like, a separate, like, subspecies, and they just don't talk about animals? Because that's another thing. Like, one of my favorite gags is, like, there's two Pokemon trainers, and one of them catches something, and it's like, oh, it's Pidgey. It's the small bird Pokemon. And then one of the kids is like, what's a bird?
Yeah.
Because it's like, they don't use that word. Like, oh, it's Pikachu, the electric mouse Pokemon. It's like, okay, what's a mouse?
I guess Rattata, but then that's supposed to be a rat.
But that's the thing. It's like, are there classifications? Oh, wait, I've never seen this one. There's just straight up fish in an aquarium. And it's like, here's Ash staring at fish, and they're not Pokemon. They're like, they're not drawn cartoony. They're literally just fish. Like, you could take that from a different anime, and, like, if you photoshopped Ash out and said, can you guess what anime this is, you would just not guess Pokemon. And so it's like, well, wait, do they have fish? Like, can you just fish for food, or each of those, like, sentient that have conversations?
I don't know. And that's the thing, like, you start to asking yourself, like, how do Pokemon eat? How did evolution work on? And it's like, no, don't even ask that. Because, like, technically, the way evolutionary biology works, none of this makes sense because there are humans. And obviously, the world was not constructed for that question.
I like, here's a couple other funny examples. There's a scene where Ekans was having a nightmare that he was fighting a mongoose. And there's this other one where they're at, like, a preschool, and the preschool had, like, giraffe, like, characters holding up a swing. And they're just, like, animals. Like, it wasn't, like, a giraffe or egg.
Right. The other thing that I always think about, too, like, we look at human history and how technology advances, and after, you know, thousands of years, we went from having swords to primitive guns to nuclear weapons, right? Like, there's a trajectory to how we've advanced through that. And then you read a fantasy book that has a 10,000 year history to it, and they're still swinging swords around and shitting in outhouses. And it's like, no, there would be a need for better advancement than what we got. And I get that, like, well, I want to write a fantasy story where they shit in outhouses and swing swords. And it's like, yeah, but maybe don't have 10,000 years of history then. Like, it doesn't, I question it, right? Like, it doesn't mean it couldn't happen. It just, it's like, after this long, I would expect more than what I'm seeing.
It's also, like, I like Trigun. You ever seen Trigun?
Yeah.
I feel like they did a good job sort of doing that. What is it? It's like, it's half sci-fi when it needs to be, but it's kind of set in the West, and there's a reason.
Yep.
And I feel like they justify it well enough. It also, though, it kind of makes me wonder, like, okay, so we can go back to, what is it, with Pathfinder. I told you about this, like, Wild West campaign I'm doing, right? Yep. And the idea is, in this desert, there's some sort of magical quality where there are these storms that will, like, fuck up magic. So if you're a wizard and you cast a spell and you're too close to a storm and the weather's bad, you could just blow yourself up.
Okay.
And so it's, like, because you can't use magic, that's what, like, gets the steampunk stuff in. Because it's like, okay, we can't just magically make water, so we have to invent a machine that can pump water. And it's like, oh yeah, you know, the rest of the world is kind of just hung up on, like, a wizard can magically make it happen, so there's no reason. Like, what's that phrase? Like, necessity is the mother of invention?
Yeah.
So in this desert setting, there's, like, a big steampunk city that's built on the success of intelligent inventors, you know, pushing limits in different ways. But then the drawback of that, too, is also, like, this, like, dangerous technology that's kind of just as dangerous as magic. And it's like, you could build a power plant that could explode and kill everyone, or on the other side of the planet, a wizard could just cast meteor and blow up the city.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's kind of no winning, but in a funny way.
But you think, too, like, oh, man, these wizards can just conjure, you know, light when they need it. That's great. But most people aren't wizards. And so the light bulb, still useful.
Yes.
But no, we've all been using candles for the last 20,000 years of history, and dragons show up once in a while.
You know what's funny? Like, did you know that, like, the first washing machine, in order to power it, you had to, like, plug it into your ceiling?
Into your ceiling.
Yeah.
That sounds familiar, and I'm sure there's a reason for that. I just can't, like, what power would be in the ceiling?
For a long chunk of time, the only, like, home application of electricity was just lighting. Like, it was just the idea of not having candles anymore. It's like, oh, that's the best thing ever. Electricity solved our candle problem. It's not like, what else can we power it with? It was just the light bulb.
Yeah.
And so houses were made where, like, the only outlet is a light bulb in the center of the room. So you'd have to unscrew your light bulb and then plug in the washing machine and go, wow, it washes.
I wonder who the first dude was that was, like, designing a house and was like, hey, let's put some outlets in the walls. Like, why would you need that? Like, no, don't trust me.
Like, I'm tired of getting the stepladder to wash my clothes. I was like, yeah. Oh. It's funny. History's funny. If we went back in time, I love that picture. There's, like, that comic going around the other day where it's, like, some modern guy goes back in time to, like, medieval times. And the serfs are, like, it's like, well, so tell us, like, you know, how do you light your home without candle? How do you, you know, broadcast your messages across the world? Can you show us how to make electricity? And then there's this, like, zoomer on his phone. He's like, well, no, I don't know how.
Yeah, I think about that all the time, actually. Well, not all the time, but enough. Yeah. Where it's like, if I went back in time, I would be worthless because I technically have access to a lot of information and, like, I know things are possible, but I have no idea how to make them possible. The best I could do would be generic cleanliness. Like, hey, we should wash our hands more because bacteria bad. And they're like, what's bacteria? It's like, oh, these tiny little things that make you sick. You can't see them. They're too small. But you can eat them and they'll make you sick. And they'll be like, you're a witch. We're going to burn you at the stake for being weird. And I'll be like, just because I fucked one goat.
You know what? For like, interesting world building, I really love having, like, folklore that isn't real. And I feel like for some reason in fiction, it always turns out it's real. Like whenever there's a story about like, oh, there's a ghost in the mountain, it turns out like there really is a ghost.
Oh, that's true.
And it's like, stop doing that.
Yeah.
And like some of my favorite stories, like if you look at a like most scary ghost stories are kind of derivative of this idea of like, you don't want your toddler playing by the river. So you have to make the river sound like extra scary.
Yeah.
It's like, that's kind of what most yokai are, is like reminders to children to not only like stop wandering out in the woods, but also be polite and respect your elders. Like, that's what pretty much every yokai story turns into.
Sure.
And I was thinking about the Pied Piper. Do you know much about the Pied Piper?
Just like the Pied Piper, he led rats through the streets, and just like the marionettes, I swing from a symphony of destruction.
Yes. Did you know that it may or may not be real?
I mean, I assumed it wasn't real.
So, what's interesting with this story is it might actually be, like, a metaphorical story about, like, the plague.
Oh!
Because there's an actual historical record of, like, exactly 62 children dying in a village. Or something like that. Like, whatever the number is. It's, like, an oddly specific number that ties in with that story. And it's like, well, wait, why? And people figured out it might have actually been kind of like, you know that, like, you know, Pocket Full of Posies song is about the Black Death. Like,
yeah.
It might be kind of like that. And it's sort of like a metaphor for, like, you know, the rats came and carried the plague, and then they lost all their children.
Okay. That I mean, I would believe that.
And yeah, and the story may or may have gotten, like, told in funny ways across the years and, like, stretched far enough that people didn't understand the context, so it got, like, rewritten a couple times, but, like, there's oddly enough a historical record of a bunch of children disappearing that was never really explained. And it's like, whoa, that's kind of weird.
Having folklore and stories and stuff like that goes a long way in world building, like, or sayings and just the idiosyncrasies of life that we take for granted. Like, it's like, yeah, that needs to be in your fantasy book or your sci-fi thing. And you know what? That shit's kind of hard to come up with. I get why, like, there's not a lot of good
stuff.
It is.
Yeah. I like... they almost did it, oddly enough, in Pokemon. That one Pokemon I like to refer to as, like, the 9/11 Pokemon. Like, that had this, like, ghost story quality of it, where, like, kids in the town would tell you, like, oh, don't go to that cave, there's a monster. And it's not like, I heard there's a very powerful Pokemon on the mountain. It's more like, oh, don't go there, you'll die. And they like actively discourage it. And then you go there and it's a very strong Pokemon that's like a scary monster. And so it's like there's half truth to it, but also it wasn't like a ghost. It was just a thing.
Yeah. I know. I mean, I've bitched about the Underdark in D&D a lot on this show because it's bad. I love the Underdark as a set dressing. Like, it's super fun. It's kind of like the Star Wars thing, right? Where it's a great setting for a play, but everything's made out of cardboard. And you start thinking about how any of that shit works, and none of it does. It doesn't make any sense. And in D&D, a lot of the isolated, weirder areas just don't work. But they're fun. And I don't know how much I care, especially in the moment. Like, if I'm reading a Dresden book and he gets shoved into some version of hell, like some new plane where there's demons everywhere, and he's got to fight his way out, and he's eating mushrooms and shit in his pants because they give him diarrhea. And he's like, oh no, Guinevere, we might die. This is really scary. And then his other elf friend opens a door and pulls him out. And he's like, I did it. I'm covered in blood and I smell like diarrhea and demon guts, but we did it. And I was like, this was fun. And then tomorrow I will think back on this and be like, that was stupid as shit. Why am I reading this book?
I want to complain about World of Warcraft.
You're allowed to do that here. This is a safe space.
I think World of Warcraft is silly. Oh.
It definitely can be.
I think it's goofy. Ha 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 ha.
Do we have anything else to say? Do you actually have something to say about World of Warcraft, or are we winding down?
No, we're winding down. Okay. I could bitch for an hour. No one wants to hear that. Unless you do, you can subscribe to me on YouTube. Ha ha. I don't know. This new expansion looks a little rough. It's funny. They're doing a bunch of things that are like, oh, that's a good thing, but it's like a little thing. And it's a bunch of little things that are like overdue. So it's like, yeah, I don't think this warrants the price of the expansion, but I'm glad you're doing it. Like, I can't shame them for making good decisions.
Sure.
But it's like, can you do more?
Yeah.
I don't know. I love talking to you, Chad. You're I think you have to be like my best friend because I don't have to smell you.
I think
Richard.
Yeah, Richard. You little stinky goober schnitzel.
I miss doing the show. I hate taking 1 week off, and taking 2 weeks off was kind of like, oh.
Yeah.
I
definitely miss talking to you because this is fun. Also, I thought of that episode of SpongeBob where he sees the graffiti and it says Squidward smells and he writes good. And so, like, if I saw that with Richard, I would be like, Richard smells. And I would write good. So there you go, Richard. We got your back. Your stinky, stinky back. I don't even know Richard. Why am I being so mean? It's because I'm a little drunk.
But before we do a glad space, I want to make room for potential complaints if you're unhappy. What do you think of that new Fairly Odd Parents reboot?
Oh, I saw a screenshot of it and was torn because part of me hated it and part of me thought the art style actually wasn't that bad, but I did not actually watch the trailer. I don't think it's necessary. I'm fine with leaving Fairly Odd Parents in the past where it was. We got a couple of really great seasons. We had a couple of really fucking terrible seasons because it went on too long. We had great crossovers with Jimmy Neutron. You know, it served its purpose. There was good stuff there. I don't need more.
I feel like I'm the only person that feels optimistic about it because everybody seems to have this like negative first reaction to it.
It feels like a weird nostalgia cash grab. Oh, we have a property. We should just use it again. Was my impression.
Yeah, So I was talking to somebody about it last night, and I asked them. I didn't mean to put them on the spot. In hindsight, I was being rude. However, they said they really hated it, and it shouldn't be made. And I said, like, what would you prefer they do? Like, what could they do to fix it where you would not hate it anymore? And he said, well, I wish Nickelodeon would just make something new instead of reviving old things. And I asked him, have you watched any of the new cartoons they've put out? And he said, well, I can't think of one. And it's like, okay, well, your complaint is that they should make new things, and then you don't watch it.
Yeah. Also, so, adult.
Like, I feel like if you watched Breadwinners and you say Breadwinners is bad, then you're allowed to have that complaint. But if you're not even giving Breadwinners a chance, that's why they're doing Fairly Odd Parents again. Because Breadwinners didn't trend on Twitter.
But
when it came out,
do they need it to? I mean, Breadwinners is probably for what, like 6 to 14 year olds or 8 to 14 year olds? Like,
yeah, you know. But I mean, you know what I mean, though, right?
I do.
Like, I think that they can make new shows that stand on their own feet, but sometimes you have to do something that will get people to turn the TV on in the first place.
Yeah, that's fair.
And, you know, Star Trek Prodigy, I don't think did that. Breadwinners, I don't think did that. SpongeBob spinoff didn't really do that, but maybe this one will. I don't know.
At the end of the day, too, I mean, the people working on these shows, whether they're good or not, like, they want them to be good. You don't get hired to work on the Fairly Odd Parents thing because you hate drawing cartoons and you don't want to be in the industry. Like, the heart's in the right spot, I would say, majority. And so it can be kind of disheartening to see all the hatred and the negativity, especially for something that is not made for you. Like, I'm an adult. I don't need to like the new Fairly Odd Parents cartoon. It's not for me.
Well, yeah. But anyways, that just only because I know you like Fairly Odd Parents, I wanted your opinion on that.
Yeah, I feel bad. But I should watch the...
Talk about something mean, do something positive. We can talk about old God space. Is there anything you're glad about?
Sure. My cat scratched down my door. It's fucking really driving me goddamn nuts right now. I'm glad you can't hear it. Little bastard. Sure. So I've been fucking around with a couple of different music projects right now, and one of them... is this long-running in quotes, I generated an AI song, and I'm trying to redo parts of it, and on Monday, I did some singing warm-up, and I was like, you know what? I want to sing into a microphone, record myself, and see how this sounds in conjecture with the song. I've never done that before. I on and off practice singing, but I've never, like, sat down to try and see how good I am of it, at it. I am largely very bad at singing. Like, the last time I did this was years and years and years ago, and it was a shit show. And so I sat down on Monday to do that. And I'm not going to say it was good. I'm not a good singer. But I am better than I was 2 years ago by leaps and bounds. And you got to trust the process and the just the, you know, the something learning a new skill is it takes time and you have to practice, you have to put yourself into it. I don't do this enough with singing. So I have no expectations that I should be good at this. And so the fact that, like, I was like, hey, I don't hate this. It's not great. I'm not going to save it. I'm not going to put it in this project. But, you know, like 15% more in skill, and maybe I would. I got to get like 15% better. And then I think maybe with proper production and throw some reverb on there and maybe auto-tune the weird notes that I got wrong, and it would be fine. And I wouldn't be embarrassed to hear it. And that I was really happy to kind of notice that, like, that skill gap kind of, no, not skill gap, but, you know, the skill building itself, like, over time. And I know there's, like, some negative qualifiers to this, but I really wanted to drive home the point, like, trying to learn something new, and it's an art form especially, you're going to be bad at it until you get to a point where you're not embarrassed, and then you start getting better, and then you just have to trust the process. So I was very happy to see that in action this week.
That's a very good observation to make, and that's a very good glad space to have.
You gotta be kind to yourself, people, when you're learning something new. Unless what you're learning is like pedophilia, then you shouldn't be kind to yourself. Well, I thought that was funny.
I'm holding for applause.
Okay.
There it goes.
Richard clapped.
I'm pretty sure Richard clapped.
Hi, Richard. I missed you too. What about you, Cameron? What are you glad about?
Oh, you know what? I shouldn't, but I got a chocolate cookie.
Hell yeah.
It's in this bag.
Cookies are great. I had a cookie today. Good.
Albertsons makes good cookies.
My problem is sometimes I eat too many good cookies, and then it's like, oh, I probably shouldn't have done that. Now I feel guilty.
Yeah. I haven't had cookies in a little bit. I feel like it's okay. So I'm going to enjoy that today.
There you go.
That's my glad space. I know, so I'm bothered because I thought of something yesterday where it's like, that'd be a perfect glad space. And I thought of something else. It's like, oh, that's so good. We could talk a whole episode about that. I didn't write anything down. And I had one of those days where I didn't want to think about anything anymore.
Oh, sure. My day was decent, which was nice. I got home to try and record some stuff, and my ability to scream today was, like, really bad, which was disappointing. Which is also part of the process. Sometimes you just have bad days. And you got to accept that and do what you can and then move on. Tomorrow will be better.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with moving on.
But I'm really glad we were able to get back into the swing of this. I definitely miss doing this show. I did really enjoy the episode I did with Jean-Luc. So regular listeners, if you skip the Warrior Chats on metal music, I'd go back and check it out. We had a really fun time talking about death metal. And
yeah, I don't think we have any Warrior Chats that are worth skipping.
Oh!
I know it sounds like tooting our own horn since it's on our feed, but, like, I'm not involved with any of those, and they're all pretty good. So
Well, thank you.
I very much appreciate everybody that chips in on those.
We have fun. The funny thing is part of me is like, the ones about the Warrior Cats books are very entertaining because Emily and I have a good time, but I don't know how fun those conversations are to listen to, which I say about, like, 70% of our episodes that you and I do. I'm like, this is fun. This might be bad content, but I had fun making it.
I think that's important, and I think that's what's that word? It's kind of like motivation. Like I feel like if you sat down and scripted out the perfect episode, it could be informative. But when you're talking about something that you actually want to talk about, it's just so much better. Did you see that news with like the Watcher Network?
No.
I guess it's a YouTube channel. I don't follow them. I don't like Watcher Network. I tried watching one of the videos and it's like, man, they're trying so hard. I hate this. I don't know why they're popular. And they recently had a little bit of controversy because they announced that they were going to like leave YouTube and start their own website. And it was like a subscription thing where you had to pay to watch the videos. And it didn't go over well because they didn't present it very well.
Oh.
And they didn't think it out all the way. So it's kind of, you know, a bit egg on their face and a rocky start to that project. I don't really hold that against them, but also it was like, guys, you could have run this by anybody and they'd tell you it was a bad idea. Like, reshoot this video. But what was funny was I'm listening to this drama and they're talking about the video and how bad it is. All this network on YouTube, so blah, 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 all the fans hate them, blah, blah, blah. And then I look up at the YouTube video and I recognized one of the guys. And it's like, oh, he's part of that? And it's a guy where I watch his separate channel where he just talks about amusement parks.
Oh.
And I didn't recognize his voice because when he's doing his like Watcher Network stuff, it's like he's a different person. And when he's talking about amusement park rides, he talks about just this passionate love he has for like theme parks, for roller coasters. He interviews people that also care about it and they share stories and advice and funny jokes and interesting bits of history. And it's, you can tell he actually cares. And when he's talking about like whatever topical news or whatever, you know, I don't even know what shows he does on Watcher. And it's just sort of like it's depressing because it feels like he's reading a script. And I'm certain whatever Watcher Network's doing to get that many viewers, like they hit that algorithm right. They hit their buzzwords right. But for the people that care about amusement park rides, it's like it's maybe a smaller audience. It's a more niche thing. He doesn't get as many sponsors on that channel. But also, man, it's so much easier to listen to.
Yeah. I don't do this as much as Joe does, but like some of the stuff that Joe will watch on YouTube will be really into the weeds things on stuff that I don't even know if he cares that much about. Like there's a channel that talks about how well video games run on hardware and it'll compare.
Yes.
And like he watches like every episode that guy puts out and I don't know why, but then like sometimes I'll sit down and I'll end up watching one and it's like, oh, I don't, this dude just loves what he does. And he's really matter of fact. And there's just something kind of like nice about his, about the way he presents a video and does a channel. Or, the virtual who does the Trackmania stuff. Like, I don't fucking play Trackmania. I'll never play that game. But that dude is a really good Trackmania player and just, like, he's a good hang. Like, you watch his stream compilations and he's being clever and silly and playing this game at such a high level. And you're like, I get why people watch this. This is actually kind of fun. And it's, like you said, he's got a lot of subscribers, but it's ultimately a very niche thing.
I think like I do the same thing where I'll watch some of these like hyper focused channels where they're like they're super passionate about one specific thing and it's not even necessarily a thing that I care about, but it's also kind of like infectious to like learn about someone else's hobby.
Yeah.
You know, and we do this a lot on the VR chat group. I think we kind of just call them like autism nights, but it's like everybody kind of has like a very specific hobby. And sometimes they'll just host a night where it's like, you know what? I'm just going to talk about my aquariums. Does anyone want to hear me talk about my aquariums? And people show up and go, well, yeah, I never even thought about it before. And I'll listen to a guy explain his aquarium setup for an hour. And it's the best night of the week because it's just so interesting.
Yeah.
And all sorts of stuff I never thought about before. And he has all these interesting aquarium stories. And it's like, I never, you know, that wasn't on my bucket list or anything. I wasn't looking for this content. But he has this passion for aquarium upkeep and collecting and that like he it's funny too, because it's like I think he likes fish, but most of the stuff he was talking about was like worms and mollusks, and like he wants a sponge, but they're hard to get sea sponges. And it's like very interesting how like, yeah, this is something I know nothing about and I'm learning so much. And I, you know, like somebody else wants to do, like, they want to talk about trains, and it's like, oh, I can't wait for train night. When's train night coming?
Yeah.
And then I do my theme park night, and it's just, it's very funny how we all like share these like weird niches.
You know, there's not to get like therapy on you, but I get that a lot, and I see that online a lot, like the idea of like, man, I love my friends because they have weird hobbies and they'll just explain them to me, and they know I don't really care, but I care about them and I like learning new things. And And then I look at myself and or I'm like, I have a lot of hobbies. I just kind of assume nobody wants to hear me talk. And so like someone will ask me about like music or writing and I'll get so awkward and just be like, because it's just like, well, I'm not very good at it. Why would you want to hear me talk about this stuff? And so I'll brush the conversation away. And mentally, I know that that's like not how this works, or emotionally. No. Mentally, I know that's not how that works, but emotionally, I'm just like, no, we better not do this because, you know, you're already insufferable to be around.
I think we got to get you to join in more karaoke nights and just talk to people that actually care about music.
Yeah, the karaoke nights are fun that I've been to. I definitely want to keep going back. I wish I was so excited about some of the stuff, and then like my vocals were bad today, and it's such a mental setback despite it. I'd be trying not to make it one. It's like, no, I had a off day. It's fucking the weather changed and it rained. My allergies are playing hell. Of course, I sounded like shit. But that's not what my heart thinks, Cameron. My heart's a dumbass.
I can't sing any songs good, so I'll sing them all bad.
Yeah, I mean, there's something freeing to that.
Behold my repertoire.
I am become cringe, destroyer of worlds. That's what Oppenheimer said. He went, oh, and then the bomb fell. Let me just sneak right by ya. Japan.
What was... Oh, no, you reminded me. I thought you were going to do a different quote when you said, I am become cringe.
I feel really dumb.
What was that other one?
What other one?
Maybe there's a GIF version. Let me, it's ending of Wreck-It Ralph. Where he's like doing that little like villain mantra thing from his like support group. But it's like, I'm cringe and that's kick. And I'll never be kick and that's not cringe.
There's no way that's a real quote, right?
That's not the quote from the movie.
Oh,
no,
thank Christ. I was really scared.
It's parodying that, like, I'm bad and that's okay. And that's good and I'll never be good and that's not bad. I don't remember. It just you put this like embarrassing internet speak over it and say it out loud, and it's like, boy, that was the worst sentence I've ever heard. I have zero riz. I've left Ohio with no gyat to be found.
I just found this on Twitter, and I'm gonna send this to you, and then
what? Well, okay. I feel like there's a problem because you're the fourth person to send this
really
to me today.
Huh?
Where it's. I'm assuming this is like from some kind of furry comic or something, because it looks like these are like established characters.
I don't know.
But they're at like a fat, it's like, yeah, Big Bite fat burger joint thing. And there's like a lady and she's like, oh, those guys are arguing. They haven't eaten their giant burgers. And then they leave and then she just eats their burgers and she's fat. And that's the whole comic.
Yeah. Apparently it's some Spanish speaker who has a weird furry comic and just makes these weird six panel things. Someone's doing a deep dive on Twitter. Twitter sucks. Twitter is the dumbest fucking place ever, where I will see the worst takes about important shit next to like fake women trying to get you to subscribe to their OnlyFans, but they're probably bots, next to like the weirdest furry porn.
But that's the weird thing. It's like, this comic did not get published today. So I know that like someone somewhere retweeted it and the algorithm decided everyone has to see it today. But then everyone decided, oh, I know what Cameron wants to see, this. And they keep sending it to me.
I'm sorry.
And you're not wrong. It's funny. It's great art. I'm not telling you to not send me your silly comics, but also when you sent this to me, I did like a double take where it's like, okay, now I'm dizzy. Like, I feel like there's an issue that everyone wants to make sure that I saw this.
It sucks when we're known for a thing, right? Like, a little, you know, bit. And in my case, it's like, hey, we're doing gay furry manga. Do you want to come on crying in the book club? And it's like, well, yeah, I want to read the gay furry manga. Come on the comic book podcast to talk about that. That's my type. It shouldn't be, but it is.
I have this mental image of you like sitting in your lounge chair by the fire and you have your reading glasses in your study. And you're like reading Inuyasha manga and you get the phone call from like and it's like the little like old fashioned phone. And it's like, do you want to talk about gay furry manga? And you sigh as you close your Inuyasha book. And it's like, yes, of course.
There are worse things to be known for, but they're all illegal.
I feel like, oh, maybe that's a topic for next week's show. It's like, what illegal things are we into?
Oh, yeah. Let's do that. Let's quit some crimes. Huh? Oh, Cameron, let's leave. I don't want to leave, but I want to leave because my cat is, like, really mad that I'm not feeding him.
It's about that time. I do, though. So it's annoying because we've missed multiple episodes this year. So I feel like we haven't actually done that many episodes to warrant it. But by the calendar, it's almost time for a music club again.
Yeah, that is true.
So I don't know if you want to think about something. I feel like I have an album in mind that I would be fun to share. So whenever you're in the mood, we could just spring that. Okay. But I also had another idea. I want Richard to recommend an album or two, and we'll review that one.
Oh, that sounds fun.
So we might do a Richard pick next. We might do our own personal pick next and do that one next time. But I love Music Club. And I love mixing it up and theming it sometimes. So.
Also, I just like hearing stuff I might never hear. So I don't know what Richard's taste in music is. So it's like, oh, I might discover a band I like. Or one I really don't like, but that'll be a story. And that's fun, too.
And that's kind of the fun of Music Club, I think, is, you know, sharing this stuff and getting out of your comfort zone a little bit.
All right. I approve. And then I'm going to hit stop because it's... I need to leave. But I've really enjoyed our time here.
Bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye. Bye. Goodbye.